Welcome to the CMO Podcast, where we interview business owners, leaders, and marketing professionals to find out their lessons and stories for success.
Welcome to the CMO Marketing Podcast, episode number 990, with your host, me, Simon Dell, formerly of the Simon Dell Podcast and formerly of the Paper Planes Marketing Podcast. And if you go back and listen to episode number 88, you'll see why we are now the CMO Marketing Podcast. And please do, if you get a chance, it's only 8 minutes long, and it might clear up a bit of your confusion. On the show today, we have somebody beamed live in from Austin, Texas, Sergio Alcazar. And I'm sure I've not done his the pronunciation of his surname any good or any justification whatsoever. He is an expert in the US in multicultural marketing, helping brands bridge that gap between different cultures in order to help them reach more markets. He owns a organization, a business called the Rest of the World Agency. And as I say, he's in Austin in Texas. He is a fascinating guy to talk to. He is extremely interesting, extremely knowledgeable, with a long, long experience in dealing with brands and helping them with their multicultural challenges. Obviously, those multicultural challenges are different in the US than they are in my home. I was going to say my home country of Australia, but I was born in the UK. So all three of those places, Australia, UK and US, have very, very different multicultural challenges. So we talked to him about why it's important that your brand should be considering these challenges. Tackle them. We'll also talk about who's doing it well, and lots of other things as well. But extremely interesting chat, and well worth you tuning into. Before we jump into that, as I say, usual, a little bit of housekeeping. Please rate and review us on iTunes, the CMO Marketing Podcast. Give us 5 stars and a nice word if you can. Come and find us at www.cmo.com, C-E-M-O-H. Feel free to email me, simon@cmo.com, or add me on LinkedIn, Simon Dell. I'd love to hear from people who listen to the show, no matter where you are in the world. If you happen to have anybody that is a good prospective guest for us, please contact us as well. We are looking for guests. We are actively looking for guests. Guests we want of people with interesting stories. That's number one. Second is people that have experience in the SME marketplace. So while Sergio obviously has more experience in the big end of town with the bigger brands, it's still an interesting story, but we are still very much looking for people who deal with SMEs on a daily basis. And also we're looking for people with a very, very specific skill set or story to tell, something that you think would benefit business owners out there. So please get in contact with us. You can email me directly at simon@cmo.com. And I will normally get back to you within 24 hours. So that's pretty much it. Our podcast boss, thepodcastboss.com, who does all of our audio engineering, Gilberto, who gets a mention in this podcast because he's Colombian. And we're talking about Latin America. So, you know, naturally we talk about Gilberto. Whether he's going to talk to me afterwards is another matter entirely. But fingers crossed. That's it. Without any further ado, let us jump into the podcast and let's hear from Sergio Alcazar. So welcome to the CMO Marketing Podcast, Sergio Alcazar. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure.
And you're in Austin, Texas, aren't you?
Austin, Texas, home of the brave, yes.
And you're going to have to, because everybody talks about Austin as being this, you know, big tech, like the next kind of tech culture. It just, every time you hear people talk about Austin, it sounds like a really exciting place to hang out.
I think it is. I think that part of that reputation comes because we host South by Southwest, which, as you know, it's a very large festival that combines film, music, and tech. The tech part has been very, very, very popular for the last 10 years. Of course, we didn't have it this year in March, but it's a phenomenal convention. The city paralyzes for a week. A lot of important things happen here. I believe that Twitter was launched here, and You know, a lot of things happening. Yeah. So it's a very vibrant city. It also, Texas is a very interesting state because it gives a lot of tax breaks for opening new businesses. Yeah. And okay. The housing is still very affordable compared to California. So a lot of entrepreneurs from California are moving to Texas and starting companies here. And then you also have, like, you know, the second largest Facebook campus is here.
Okay.
Google has a very large company here. So it's a very interesting city. Yeah.
I've been to Texas once. I spent a week in Houston when my brother used to live there. And for people who live in Queensland, Australia, we know how hot it can get here. I think Houston was probably the only place I've been to where I went, it genuinely was hotter than being in Queensland.
Yeah, hotter and humid.
Yeah,
because it's basically, Houston is basically in a swamp. It gets really hot. But Texas, you know, I've been in Texas for 20 years in Austin, originally from Mexico. I lived many years in New York before. And Texas is growing on me. My idea from Texas was, for Texas, when I was living in New York, my idea of Texas was, you know, like a little conservative and cowboy kind of culture.
Yeah.
Austin is it's an oasis in the center of the state. I've been very, very surprised. I call it home now.
So your background is multicultural marketing, which we'll talk about in more detail in a minute. But give us a sort of an overview about what your role is and a little bit about the Rest of the World company that you run at the moment.
Yes. Let me first tell you a little bit about that thing of the background, because I arrived to multicultural marketing after many years just being an ad guy. I'm a copywriter, creative, for my entire career. As I mentioned, I'm originally from Mexico. When I was in Mexico, I started working at Leo Burnett, the network. And through Leo Burnett, I moved as a career director for the office of Leo Burnett in the Dominican Republic, which is a very interesting place. And then I spent some time in Venezuela at a time in which Venezuela was still a very large and strong advertising market. Then I went to New York, and then I came to start Latin Works in Austin. So the multicultural was something that I didn't understood in all the years that I work in Latin America, because in Latin America, it's basically you're working for the local clients and markets, Mexico, Dominican Republic, etc. When I came to New York, I discovered this whole idea of multicultural marketing and discovered this idea of a country within a country. And particularly at that moment, my main focus was on the Hispanic market. I don't know if you have an idea of the size of the Hispanic market in the United States, but there are 58 million Hispanics living in the United States today. And those are the legal ones. We estimated that, so the ones that you can count, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We estimate that there's maybe 8 or 9 million more. So that puts you at around 60, conservatively, 65 million Hispanics in the United States. That's
a lot.
There's more Hispanics in the United States than in any other Hispanic-speaking country, with the exception of Mexico. There's more Hispanics in the U.S. than Spaniards in Spain, right? So it's a gigantic, gigantic market. When you add also the population of the African-American and the Asian-American populations, today in the United States, 38% of the entire population come from diverse multicultural backgrounds. So it is something that is very present and it's very important. In the case of Hispanic in particular, which is still my main focus, because that's where a lot of the brands are investing money for growth. Mm-hmm. Hispanics are also younger than the so-called general market population, like the non-Hispanic Americans. They are younger and they are very concentrated in the largest states in the country. So they are concentrated in California, in Texas, in Florida, in Nueva York, in Illinois, and a few others. But just by virtue of having those five, the biggest states in the country, really, if you want to make business, if you want a brand to grow, especially one of those brands that want to get the millennial or the Gen Z, you need to understand and get Hispanics. So multicultural marketing, what it is how do we break this notion that America is just a monolithic place with of sameness of people and understand that there are different cultures that are coexisting and that need an understanding for brands to be able to grow. So that's the whole idea of multicultural marketing. And my new agency, Rest of the World, it's a new agency because I had a previous large agency before that became very big. We sold it to Omnicom, and I started this new one a couple of years ago. Rest of the World is the name of the agency. It's more of a still in the same emphasis of multicultural marketing, but more not trying to be a full service agency, but working very strongly on strategy and creative production in the ample sense, you know, social media, TV, etc. But with a particular emphasis on clients and brands that are also interested in having some sort of social impact inside of the United States for minority communities. Because there's still, even though the numbers are as large as 65 million of Hispanics in the United States, there's a lot of disadvantages in terms of the financial level of this population, the educational gap between Hispanics and non-Hispanics, the healthcare issues that Hispanics have. As a matter of fact, the COVID-19 is particularly affecting Hispanics and African Americans in the United States, disproportionately affecting Hispanics and African Americans. And this has to do with a lot of things. I mean, there's in April, May, at the height of the COVID epidemic in the United States, basically all the communication was in English. And although the majority of Hispanics in the United States speak English and understand and consume English language media, the oldest generations, meaning those pioneers that came here 30, 40 years ago, most likely from low economic level and low levels of education, they are never really feel comfortable in English. And they were missing all the government ads and announcements that everybody else were getting. So there's a big disproportion of how the COVID, as just to put an example, is affecting minorities of color in the United States.
Do you think that's, I would go off on a slight tangent there, but do you think that's also down to the cultural differences in the way that maybe the Hispanic community and the Black African community treat family, in the sense that, you know, in a closeness that they're closer to their family, that they are, you know, rather than perhaps Caucasian Americans? Is that, do you think there's a family aspect there to the spread as well?
Yes, but I don't think, yes, but it's not the fact that when you love your family, that's why you're spreading the virus. It has also to do with the economic conditions.
Right, right.
The income of Hispanics and African Americans is considerably low than the general population. Yeah. And the neighborhoods where we live, we tend to live in urban, in the outskirts of urban towns. And in those neighborhoods, there's very limited space. So many times you get, like, for example, if you look at the epicenter of the COVID epidemic in New York City, the epicenter, it's in the neighborhood of Queens called Jackson Heights, right?
Yep.
And Crown Queens. Yep. That's the epicenter. And that is primarily a Hispanic neighborhood. And what you get there is in a 30, 40 meter apartment. I don't know if you think meters or square feet, but in a 30, 40 meter apartment, you have 5-6 people that, the other hand, they cannot afford to work from home, because many of these people work in services and industries that you need to be earning your money day to day, a service industry on the streets and things of that nature. So you cannot afford to stay home, and you live in very close quarters with the entire family. So there's a lot of social economical conditions that create a perfect storm.
And I guess that's the key when it comes to multicultural marketing, is to understand the differences between the cultures. And I guess that's what your business is doing, is helping brands navigate those differences and how they then, how they appeal to those differences.
Absolutely. Yet, even though what I have been telling you about COVID, it feels a little like a downer, there's also really a lot of optimism. Because as I mentioned before, this is a community that is very young and represents really the youth of the nation. If you look at the growth of the United States in the last 10 years, the growth of the population in the country in the last 10 years, it comes from multicultural families. Basically, the Caucasian white, however we wanna call the general public, it's having less kids than the multicultural groups, particularly yeah. Hispanics. So the growth of the country, let me put you an example. In Texas today, and this is going to blow your mind, in the state of Texas, which is the second largest state in the country, in the public school system from kindergarten to the end of high school, which in the United States is 12th grade, yep. 74% of the students are Hispanic.
Wow.
On public schools. Yeah. 74% of students in Texas today are Hispanics. So when you project that for what's going to be the future of Texas in the next 10, 15 years, that means that that amount of people, 70%, 70 plus percent of the working force of Texas in 15 years is going to be Hispanic. Yeah. So that's why it's very important that companies start investing now in narrowing those gaps, education, financial literacy, healthcare, etc. Because if not, you're putting at risk the future of the state and the future of the country. Texas is now already what's called a minority-majority state, meaning there's more Hispanics than non-Hispanics in the state of Texas.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean that they are Hispanics that came from Mexico or Latin America. They were born in the United States. As you know, Texas used to be part of Mexico. So many, many Hispanics have been here since this was Mexico. But they still self-describe and self-identify as Hispanics in the census. And there's still a lot of catching up to do in many of those communities, especially on the border.
So obviously, Australia's got a very different multicultural footprint than America has. I know you said to me earlier that you've been to Sydney once, and we were talking about your experience with Ayers Rock and the camels.
Beautiful. Yes, I never imagined that. It got me by surprise to get to the desert in Australia and see camels.
Yeah, there was a lot of wild camels here. There's a lot of stories and fake stories about camels in Australia and about how many there are and all that kind of thing. But one of our clients is actually a camel farm. It's the third biggest camel farm in Australia. The third biggest camel farm in the world is actually here in Australia.
Amazing.
Ayers Rock, you visited Ayers Rock or Uluru, depending on, you probably would have called it. When did you actually visit?
2008.
Okay, yeah. Uluru is a very sacred site for the indigenous community here in Australia. And only recently, I think, 3-4 months ago, just before COVID hit, they've stopped people climbing up it, so you can no longer climb up it.
Oh, I was there. I tried to climb as much as I could.
But obviously, the makeup of the Australian population is a combination of Indigenous Australians. There's a lot of Asian, Southeast Asian population here: Chinese, Indonesian, Vietnamese. Lots of diversity, and especially in the obviously in the major CBDs and the centres in Sydney and Melbourne and to a lesser degree, Brisbane. What if you're running a small business? How do you start off by navigating the concept of being a more multicultural product or a more multicultural company? I mean, what's the first step?
It may sound counterintuitive, but I think that the first thing is to look for the similarities. Any, I'm talking from a point of view of marketing. Any consumer. I hate the word consumer, but you know what I mean. Yeah, every person is a person first and a cultural background second, right? A teenager is a teenager first, and there's teenager universal conditions that can give you clues on how to talk to them on the trends. And the second is that on top of being teenagers, they have two cultures, a culture at home and a culture outside of the house, which is one of the most interesting things to understand, especially in mature multicultural societies like the United States. Hispanics live an American life. especially when you see the generation, the younger generation that is already born, that maybe were born in the United States, but parents born in Mexico. By the way, Mexico, of those 65 million of Hispanics in the United States, almost 70% are Mexican. Okay, so right. so the Mexican market is gigantic. So when you look at those young kids that are already born in the U.S. with parents born in Mexico, they speak both languages, and they can go back and forth between Spanish and English. It's almost like a superpower, right? Because you obviously have all much other much many more possibilities at your disposal. But understanding that they are American and they live an American life, but there are things of the culture at home that are expressed at home that are manifested by the proximity with family, as an example that you put before. So it's finding what are the things and at what moments of the day are they more American or more Hispanic, and understanding that beyond being Hispanic, they are people first. So I think that the one of the key things on a multicultural society, a mature multicultural society, is treat people like people first, and then use their culture to understand certain behavior or to understand the relationship that they have with certain services or with certain brands. There are brands that are global brands that have a lot of impact in Latin America. So when people come here, those brands are the preferred brands at the beginning until you start discovering new brands in the United States, etc. So it's more about finding the similarities and then using the differences to be a little more insightful and more nuanced, but not by separating the groups and talking to them as if they were in the bubble. And that's something that happened for many years in the United States. There was a Hispanic marketing industry that had separate TV channels that only speak in Spanish. They had their own parties, their own music. It's almost like they were running in parallel paths to the general market. But nowadays, and technology has been a great equalizer, and as the population grow and there's more Hispanic kids born in the U.S., really the interesting thing is being ambicultural. You can be part of both cultures at the same time, and it's fascinating to see how you can switch back and forth between one and the other.
And I guess that's something that's come out of, you know, the media side of things. I guess music and TV shows are not necessarily created for particular cultural demographics. They are, you know, they're popular for everybody. So, you know, if you're wanting to advertise through, you know, Game of Thrones, you've got all sorts of different people watching Game of Thrones. It's not just, you know, white Americans watching it. It's, you know, Latin Americans, you know, Black Africans, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And that can go either way also into the very smart marketing and the very bad marketing. There's a problem of representation of what we call people of color, which is multicultural people. There's a problem of representation in the United States, especially in media and especially in Hollywood. If you look at the roles of Hispanics in Hollywood traditionally, women are sexy. And they, if you look at any Jennifer Lopez movie, she is hot. That's her role, and that's why she conquers the boss of the company. That's how she advances in life. So there's an over sexualization of Latino women in media. Sofia Vergara, I don't know if you know who she is.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so she's voluptuous. And a little dumb, but she can do anything she wants in life because she's super hot, right? So those kind of simplifications really hurts the representation of Latinos. And if you look, for example, at forget about women, if you look at the culture of narcos, you know, drug cartels, Pablo Escobar, El Chapo. The TV and all the message about narcos and narco culture is really affecting the representation. On the other hand, you have a president now that during his career, he called Hispanics and Mexicans in particular criminals, drug traffickers. He wanted to build a wall, etc. So So there's a we are going through a period of really bad PR, to say it in the simplest term. And then when you look at what's happening with the African American community, which I'm sure you're following all the news of the Black Lives Matter and the systematic abuse that has never changed. Really, there's a big chunk of the population between Hispanic and African American that are at a moment in which are starting to demand better representation in the media and better representation in order to be us, the ones that write our stories, and to have people of color really in positions of decision making in order to be able to at least have an impact on the editorial of entertainment and movies and news. Music is a different thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Music, in the year 2019, 2020, if you look at the Billboard Top 100 of the United States, there has never been more Latin music hits.
Yeah.
If you look at the Super Bowl, the biggest event in TV in the United States this year was Jennifer Lopez and Shakira. So it's okay if we dance, but but in the rest of the media, we are not very, very well represented yet. But that is changing, and things like the ones happening now with Black Lives Matter, which in reality is also advocating for a more fair treatment of people of color. Things are going to change, and I think it's going to be exciting, and I think it's important that it happens, because as I mentioned, many of the youth of the country is Hispanic and color, and it's important that they grow with better representation in the media.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'll be honest, the guy who does the sound engineering for this podcast is Gilberto, who's a long-term friend of mine, is Colombian, and he constantly gets various standard Colombian jokes targeted mm-hmm. towards him, and you know he gives it back to me as much as I would give it to him. I guess it's one of those things. It's that, you know, we don't meet, you know, obviously in Australia you don't meet many Colombians, so you know,
yes,
having a, you know, Colombian friend or a Colombian contact and working with one, then you know that sort of becomes, I always think it depends on the intent behind the conversation. Does that make sense?
100%. And not only that, I am all for good jokes. And it's very hard for me to be personally offended by being Mexican. And there's a lot of jokes about Mexico.
There is, yeah.
And I think that I think that deep down it's very funny that you know, it's funny, right?
Yeah.
But as long as we understand that there are things in the system against us.
Yeah.
That things are not equally, that the opportunities are not equal.
Yeah.
And that an African-American, for example, an African-American 21, 22-year-old in the United States, he has a system. There's a disadvantage, and it is real. And that thing needs to stop. And I think that at this moment, if everybody's particularly serious and not joking much, is because the moment is very viral and very important. But there's going to be a moment in which we're going to come back and be able to laugh a little bit about it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's nothing about there are certain things and certain moments to take things lighter. But it is a fascinating thing, and I think that at the end it's going to be a very welcome change for the country. But in the meantime, please. Say hello to Gilberto.
he'll be listening to this as he edits, and I'll no doubt get a message from him as he's in the middle of this. I guess my last question for you today is that one of the things I think a lot of small businesses or any size business really is concerned about is getting it wrong, because it is very easy to get it wrong. In terms of how you appeal to certain demographics and how you appeal to certain cultures. And that goes across cultures. I mean, it's, you know, you see how some companies are treated women and some people, and different age demographics and things like that. It's very easy for a company to make a giant fuck up. And obviously then the challenge is that it doesn't matter what size company you are. You could be a small family-run restaurant, or you could be a giant international skincare company. that Twitter will come after you. Those, you know, what they would perhaps describe as the woke left would come after you and name and shame you. And so I wonder whether you find that that sort of paralyzes people into not trying to appeal to a broader cultural demographic because they're afraid of the consequences of getting it wrong.
Yes. And it's a shame. I think there's a lot of people that is abusing of this moment, at least in the United States. A lot of people that is abusing this. There's a culture of what they call a cancel culture.
Yeah. Yeah,
in which anything that the minimum thing that somebody says that is wrong, that person gets basically crucified in the media. And it is a shame because what's happening, as you well said, is that people's paralyzing, that people that have good intentions are rather don't say anything and don't do anything for that fear of being wrong. I think it's one of the prices that we are paying on this moment, the abuse that many people is suffering from speaking their mind politically. I mean, not even a question. Yeah. It's yeah. Terrible. What I would say is don't make an obvious mistake because there's obvious mistakes, right? Make sure that when you talk, you have your facts right. Be respectful. But do not only talk. I think that one of the things that we are seeing now that is working best is companies that is supporting minority communities, not just talking about, is it fair, is not fair, I think this, I think that, but it's people, companies that are supporting. For example, one of my previous clients, Target, which is a big retail chain. I don't know if you know.
Yeah, We have Target here, but it's a different brand, different company. But yes.
Yeah. So Target is based in Minneapolis. As you know, Minneapolis is the city where this new chapter of Black Lives Matter started with the murder of George Floyd. And in Minneapolis, Target is ubiquitous. There's a Target everywhere, right? So. During the protests for the killing of George Floyd, there were a lot of Targets that were burned or looted, etc. Right? More because they are ubiquitous. Some people argue that they deserve it, quote unquote, because Target has been donating money for the police for many years, which is one of those abuses. I mean, donating money for the police is something that good citizens used to do in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
But what Target is doing is, and since before these protests, Target is a company that has invested a lot of money in improving the quality of the neighborhoods where they do business. Educating, because in every local Target, the employees of that Target many times are part of that community. So if you go at a Target in a Hispanic neighborhood, the majority of the employees working at that Target are Hispanic, same with African American and all that. So Target has a great track record of investing in communities of color. And what happened to them a couple of months ago in Minneapolis by no means erased that record. So what Target is doing is continue to doing that, continue to invest in the communities, doing more than saying. They did not complain. They understood that they were part of the fabric of a society that was hurting at this time, but they start doing things. So it's like a very ample, obvious advice, but it's rather than talk, do.
Yeah.
And that is the best way, especially in the United States now, in these times in which everybody is trying to heal, actions speak louder than words.
Yeah, yeah. Look, my last question for you today, you've obviously just mentioned Target, which is great, but what are some of the other companies out there that are doing a good job with this?
Many, and every time more are trying, and some are doing a bad job, but yeah, trying to do something. And not a bad job from an offensive point of view, but everybody's trying to catch up now.
Yeah.
Almost many of them, in order to show that they are not racist, etc. You know, yeah, there's confusion.
Yeah.
But traditionally, the beer companies have done a great job.
Yeah.
Anheuser-Busch InBev has traditionally done a great job. Molson Coors as well. McDonald's has done a wonderful job from a point of view of investing in education. People can argue, yes, but on the other hand, it's giving us diabetes and making minorities fat, etc. So all that argument is real, but they invest a lot of money on education. Nike is an interesting case because Nike has always been first at advocating social justice, particularly for the African American community. Of course, the rise of Nike in the last 30 years is very tied to the lifestyle and urban culture and sports of basketball, basically, of the African American culture. Yet they have always been advocating for social justice. Somebody criticized them. Cindy Gallup, which I don't know if you know who she is. She's a British marketer that started all the thing of the trip of bringing more diversity to Madison Avenue, etc. So Cindy Gallup noticed the other day that even though Nike is always advocating and creating ads in support of African American and social justice, there's not one African American in the board of directors or high positions at Nike. So what she was asking Nike was, okay, it's great that you're doing all these incredible, inspiring ads to support the community, but until you empower them in the conversation and you create this sense of progress for them inside of your organization, maybe what you're doing is advertising. So that is an interesting point, but Nike has been good at working on it. So many companies that for many years, for me it's important, companies that invested in these communities before it was fashionable to do so.
Yeah.
And those are the ones that are doing better because they started before. But hopefully it's going to become a normal thing, just to understand again that 36-38% of the population of the United States is people of color, and the majority are young. They are your future, and you need to change.
I can't echo that enough. I mean, I think certainly Nike has been, whenever I've used advertising as an example of creating an emotional engagement with the end user, I've often used the old the Nike adverts, the Colin Kaepernick ones. But also I love what Anheuser-Busch did, because they're one of their most recognized adverts around the world was the WhatsApp advert, the Budweiser WhatsApp advert, which was for African-American guys. That went round the world almost before advertising was viral. That was, you know, before we had Facebook and before we had Twitter. That was, you know.
Yeah, it was 2000. It was in 2000, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was being shared, everybody knew that without the need for social media to exist. So that was the power and the impact of what was a really simple advert. And then I think they've actually re-released it.
Yes, they did.
Recently to target, was it mental health?
Yes, it was about staying home at the beginning of COVID.
That was it, yeah. And the mental health of just calling up your friends and making sure they were okay and that kind of thing.
Yeah, because you were missing going out and all that. Yes, it was very clever. Yes, Anheuser-Busch has been investing in multicultural communities for since the 80s. Yeah. I mean, a long time.
I tell you what's funny about rewatching that advert recently with the COVID, the COVID idea behind it, was everybody using normal phones. and then using a phone that was on the wall with a cable. And I'm going, oh, I remember those, you know.
I remember that in my apartment when I was a kid in Mexico, there was a phone connected to the wall, but with a very, very long cable, so you can take it to your bedroom. but it was still connected to the
Mate, I remember you and me would probably both remember the dial phones where you had to do the with your finger and go round. But that was
The rotary, right? Yeah.
And dial up internet with your little modem as well. Your 28K modem.
That was the other day.
Yeah. Oh God.
All that noise. Yeah. Yeah.
The kids these days don't know how well they have it, do they?
Well, it's different. I tend not to be nostalgic just because you get old really fast.
Yes.
But that was fun. It was a fun time.
Sergio, thank you very much for your time today. It's been very enlightening, and I hope people got a lot out of it. And look, once again, if you come to Australia, I'm sure you'd be welcome here with open arms.
Thank you, Simon. My pleasure. Stay well.
You too. Thank you.